Pushkin.
You can find inspiring stories almost anywhere. For instance, check out the co-founders of Girls Who Do Interiors. This Miami-based design company was started by three friends when they were still in school. And right from the start, they turned to Chase for Business for everything from banking and payment acceptance to credit cards. And they handle them all in one place with the Chase mobile app. It's so important to have that kind of help when you're just starting out. Learn more at chaseforbusiness.com. Make more of what's yours. Chase mobile app is available for select mobile devices. Message and data rates may apply. JPMorgan Chase Bank, NA member FDIC. The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
Smart journalism. Fascinating topics. Words that describe CNN's podcast, The Assignment with Audie Cornish.
Last year, the Army missed its recruitment goal. It had 65,000 spots to fill and came up 10,000 short of that target. Why is it so hard to recruit? How's the Pentagon responding? And how are the voices of service members on social media shifting the balance?
Listen to The Assignment with Audie Cornish wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Talk Easy. I'm Sam Fragoso. Welcome to the show. Today, I am joined by actor, writer, and director, Julie Delpy. Her work spans nearly four decades, dating back to 1985, where a 15-year-old Delpy performed in Jean-Luc Godard's film, Detective. Between then and now, you've seen her in Kieslowski's Three Color Trilogy, Blue, White, and Red, Richard Linklater's Before Trilogy, Sunrise, Sunset, and Midnight, or films by directors like Jim Jarmusch in Broken Flowers, or Todd Solondz in Wiener Dog. But acting is only one half of Delpy's story. The other comes as a prolific writer and filmmaker, some of my favorites being 2 Days in Paris, 2 Days in New York, and Skylab. Her latest endeavor, called On the Verge, finds her doing a bit of everything. As writer, director, actor, Delpy focuses on four mothers in pre-pandemic Los Angeles, sorting through problems of marriage, work, parenting, and everything in between. Here's a clip from On the Verge, now available to stream on Netflix.
Switching career in your 40s as a woman.
Switching careers in your 40s as a woman.
You know how you have one of those days and it just feels like everything is collapsing all around you? And then all of a sudden, it's just fine again.
Oh my God. Think about Ratatouille. What made him a star?
So you want me to be inspired by a male Disney rat?
Newsflash, buddy. Your son's moving in. Bye.
Oh my God, the whole thing.
Do you mind if I ask you an odd question?
No, go ahead.
What scent do you have on? It's intoxicating.
Gotta go.
Okay, what's going on? Are you having a heart attack?
God, I'm 46, not 96. I'm having a panic attack.
At the top of this talk, we get into where On the Verge came from and why it was made now. From there, Delpy and I talk about everything. Motherhood, growing up in Paris with two actor parents, coming of age in a film industry that objectified her, that made the decision to keep being an artist all the more impressive as she battled misogyny and predation. We talk about the work in the frame and her life outside of it, We talk about our very short, maybe too short time here together in this moment, right now, alive and kicking and grateful. Grateful to be doing this show and grateful to Julie for coming on it. I have a feeling you'll understand my gratitude for her and all that she does by the end of this episode. So thank you, Julie, and thank you for being here. Enjoy. Julie Delpy, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
How are you doing right now?
For real?
For real.
Not great. I had shingles 2 years ago, and I still have nerve pain from it, and sometimes it flares up, and it's flared up in the past 3 days. It's like really a nightmare, just because of stress, by the way.
It's stress-induced.
Completely. Nothing else. Stress, 100%.
What are we stressed about?
Work. Work is always stressful to me. I mean, it's not, the actual work is not stressful. Doing my work is not stressful. It's all the stuff around it, the financing, the people liking, not liking, critics, wrecking 8 years of work, you know, shit like that for no reason. Can I say the word shit?
You can say anything you want.
2.5 years ago, I had a bit of a moment that was very, very difficult. So, you know, it doesn't seem like much because you're like, oh, you know, we can just wreck there. Career in one critic, but you know, it's it gets very difficult. Like it affects your mental health, and then eventually it affects your emotions, which affects your stress level, which affects your health, and then you end up with shingles and pain for the rest of your life. So
in 2019, you said something to the effect of, I may quit movies forever and become a doctor, which I didn't believe for a second.
No, but I didn't, it's not that I considered it, is that I was so drained by the nastiness of the business in general. Like you fight mountains and you're, you know, you try to go against like, you know, an entire system and then you get crushed to the ground, you know, by a couple of people. And it's a hard to be someone that express yourself openly about everything. You pay the price. You know, yes, it helps others and things move forward because of it a little bit. No, I'm not saying I've changed things. Things change because of me. But, you know, it's like a little drop in the ocean of trying to change things, you know, and you pay the price. You know, you have to expect that. You know, we talk a little bit about people in the spotlight, mental health, but not enough and not in relation to the amount of work and the amount of beating up you get afterwards, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it affects you. Maybe it doesn't affect you if you're getting a job that involves you just doing your job and you don't give a shit about it. But if you actually evolve yourself emotionally in it, which I do sometimes in my projects because they take so long to make, you know, you definitely get hurt.
I feel like you do that every time.
Yeah, and I think I'm going to stop. I can't take being emotionally involved in something like writing my guts out in a movie, not be credited or stuff like that. I can't just do this anymore. I just can't do it. I have to move on to being just, you know, I'm good at what I do as a filmmaker. I should just take a script, make it a great film, and not worry anymore about anything. And I think it's going to work out better for me. I really think so. At least for my life, for my shingles, for all my physical manifestation of my anxiety, you know. My husband, my son, my, you know, my friends, you know, my dad, you know, everyone is like suffering because of my suffering, you know, so it's not nice.
But you did put yourself in this new show of yours.
Part of myself, yeah. Part of things that I feel, yeah, yeah. And the complexity of being my age or even being a woman, period, or even being in a relationship or having a kid or
mm-hmm.
working, trying to not destroy your family life with working too much as a woman, because you also have this guilt, I think, as a mother to when you work a lot, you know, you have the guilt of not spending enough time with your kid or kids.
When you worked with Kieslowski, he said to you, the trick of storytelling is to take a seed of truth and make it a tree. And as we're thinking about this new show, I was curious, what was that seed for this project?
The seed of truth there is really all those women I know, and me including myself in them, that are still figuring things out. some people have it all worked out, but maybe I'm not talking about those women. And I don't fully believe the people that say they have it all worked out. I don't know what that means, actually. And
I don't know those people.
Yeah. And I think some people are in denial and they think everything's great in their life. And I think one of the character like that is Yasmin in a way. She's one of them that seems like her life is perfect. She's raising her kids. She's, you know, her husband has money. She shouldn't be worried. And she's freaking out all the time because she feels she has no purpose, you know? Because I think for women that are intelligent and active and that have had an active life, to be completely a mother and no other definition of who she is, she doesn't feel good about it. So she's freaking out until she finds a purpose again. My character, it's some other problem. She feels she overextends herself. She has their entire family. She's feeding her entire family. You know, she doesn't work. She's on the street. I mean, basically, she doesn't have money outside of her work, and her husband doesn't work.
How much of you and your parenting is in this show?
That's one thing I notice about all of my friends. We can agree on so many things, politics, taste on art, films, blah, blah, blah. Parenting, completely different. Like, we couldn't be more different. Like, why are you doing that? I don't even get involved anymore because I so disagree with most of them that I just leave it. I believe in exposing children to, like, a certain amount of truth that they're not going to fall from a cliff at 15 when they find out about the world, you know, or 13, really, or 12 or whatever. You know, I feel like, you know, Mitridate, you know, like you give a little poison every day to make sure that they don't end up dying of poisoning one day. So, you know, it's just very different. You know, some people shelter their kids completely, you know, so I wanted to show that also in the show, like they all have different ways of dealing with it. And there's a big discussion with Yasmin actually and her son. It's like he's exposed to her past, which is Iranian, Khomeini and stuff. And at the same time, he believes in Santa Claus. So he's like this extreme of both. And I just thought it's interesting to dig into that as well. And my parenting is pretty much like, exposing, telling the truth all the time, not sugarcoating it, not bullshitting anything. You know, I protect them from visuals and stuff that are really traumatic. You know, like I wouldn't show my son, for example, what I was shown at 11 in school, which is a Night and Fog, which is a documentary on concentration camp. I think that was so traumatic. Like I still shake sometimes thinking about it, but it's good that he knows about it.
You protect them from some things, but you still have friends of yours that frown upon your parenting.
Of course. Of course. I'm exposing, like some think I'm exposing my son to too much information.
He's going to find it anyway.
Yeah, he's going to find it anyway. And I feel like lying about it is even worse because then he finds out and he thinks you lied to him about certain things and stuff. I think it's terrible.
How much of your parents do you see in your parenting? I wonder because both of them were actors as... You grew up in Paris.
Yeah.
And this is what you said of them. At home, they created a sense of fairness. They believed in happiness, love, and truth. Their friends, dreamers, poets, painters, were all like them.
Yeah, it's true. I was raised with a lot of love, a lot of poetry, a lot of art, but at the same time, a lot of truth, which can be sometimes hard to handle. I don't regret it, though. You know, sometimes I think I'm pretty traumatized psychologically for a lot of reasons, but you know, but mostly because I entered the movie business at 14. Even though my dad had PTSD, which was difficult to handle sometimes, he had ups and downs and rage issues and stuff. Which, by the way, I forgive him completely because he had a very, very, very difficult childhood. So, but yeah, lots of love, art, but almost too much. Like not too much. You can never have too much. But everything. I was exposed to everything. I mean, I remember my dad doing a play where he was playing a woman, and I remember him changing period pads on stage. And I was like, what, 9 years old? But as a memory of it, I thought it was funny. Also, half of the other men were playing men on stage, and I remember them wearing a pink tiny dress, and he never wore underwear, the other guy. And I would always see his penis, and I was always, you know, and I remember... It's shocking, but it was funny, you know, like as a kid, I thought it was hilarious, but a little bit shocking, but funny, you know.
I can see how when you're telling this to your friends, they're thinking.
Yeah, that's a little much.
You said most of your PTSD comes from entering the movie business at 14.
Oh, yeah. Well, because it's like, you know, right? You're 14, you're very pretty. You don't know.
No, only one of us did a Godard film as
knows.
A teen. No, I don't know. I grew up in Chicago.
No, actually, Godard was not the bad part. Godard was very respectful and very nice to me. No, because everyone knows. It's like I had to battle, you know, one producer after one director who wanted to get in my pants, you know, at 14, even at 14. You know, and I would make up stories about like, no, I don't like older men because my dad was spanking me. I mean, like making up bullshit to just get away from them. You know, I just didn't know what to come up with, you know, so I must have passed for a bit of a crazy person because I was making up stories all the time to get away from them. Or I was being aggressive, but aggressive, I figured out that you pay the price. So I would, you know, just figure out ways to get out of situations. And then I would avoid those situations as much as possible because I knew when they were coming.
In an interview this year, you said, deep down, I hated my condition as a young actress, this role of muse.
Oh, hated it, being the pretty girl.
You also said, internally, I was the opposite of my romantic physique. There were clashes. Journalists called me a moralist because I dared to say that it was disgusting for a 50-year-old guy to fuck a 15-year-old girl.
Yeah. You know, at the time in France, that happened in France when I started saying I don't find it acceptable for a great 45, 50-year-old director to be with a sometime 13-year-old girl. I was really under attack. It was a different time. Nowadays, everyone's like, oh, my God, oh, my God, oh, my God. But at the time, it wasn't, you know, I was attacking a system that was, it's okay for a great artist to be with anyone, you know. It was like the Socrates and the Greek time with little boys, you know what I mean? It was like going against that. So it was one thing, you know, and so I left for the U.S., you know, because I was like, you know, I can't deal with this stuff. And the U.S., of course, I arrived and one of the first person I met in the U.S. was, had been abused by Weinstein.
That was Catherine Kendall?
Yes. You're well informed. I said it. So yeah, Catherine, who's a wonderful girl, and she told me the story and I was like, oh God, okay. But I knew it wasn't like shocking to me because I knew that story a million times. I mean, like, not that it happened to me because I was always able to get away from it. Like it happened to me once when I was 13, when the first casting, you know, the guy asked me to take off my clothes and I run off, you know, and I was very, very clear. And I remember crying in the subway and with my dad who wanted to go punch him. And I say, no, forget it and stuff. He's like, you don't have to do this to become a good actress. You don't have to do this to, you know, my dad was really supportive of me and a super feminist. So luckily I had a feminist dad, which is also gives you two sides of the story. Like it's not, I have nothing against men. I have absolutely nothing. I love men. And the greatest supporter of women are men sometimes. And my dad was incredible.
Can I ask you a human question about this? By the way, for people listening, every time I start to say something, Julie looks at me like she's looking at someone who's never said a sentence before. With an amount of skepticism that I can only remember in childhood from my mother. So it's good to be brought back to that. When you're a teenager, you do these films in Europe, Detective, Bad Blood, there's a couple others. And most of those experiences are not particularly good. Some of them are unsafe with volatile, dangerous people acting in ways that are wildly inappropriate then and especially now. What I want to know is what in those experiences told you that you should continue acting?
I guess my family and my upbringing that are a lot of love and a lot of strength in that love. You know, love is very strong, you know, in my family, even though it's a crazy kind of love. So it gives you a lot of strength and a lot of confidence in life, even though I'm not so confident sometimes. It gives you a strength to keep on going. There's a French expression that says the caravan is going forward and the dogs are barking, meaning you move forward, right? And every round around you is trying to bug you, but you just keep on going. And so I always, you know, kept this in mind to keep on going no matter what.
To keep on going no matter what reminds me of how The Guardian described you in 2012. They wrote, in spite of her neuroses, her occasional panic attacks, and her absent-mindedness, when it comes down to it, Delpy is like a dog with a bone. When she couldn't find funding for one of her movies, she approached every backer in town until she drummed up the money. And while that's about the films you directed later on in life, I think it speaks to your kind of remarkable tenacity.
I know, but the more people know it, the more they fight me harder because they know I don't give up easily. They want to prove that they have a bigger dick than me, you know? That's like so annoying. And the more it goes, the more people are fighting me and I'm fighting a system. And people don't like people like me in general. They don't like people like me. They want people that comply.
You.
No, because you're different, right? But you know, you're not different. You're weird. No, I'm not saying that. No, but I mean, the people in the system, you're not in a system, in the Hollywood system, right? I think the people in the system want people that comply, right? There's nothing more dangerous than freedom in a system. Someone's free. You don't want free people because you don't know what they're going to do next. You know, it's funny, this image of someone strong and free means trouble when it's not true. You know, I always shoot my film on time. I never spend extra money, but I'm usually compliant to most of the issues and understanding to situations. That I'm tenacious doesn't mean that I'm impossible. It's very weird how people, but I think being a woman doesn't help. I know we're trying to get over that shit a little bit, but it's still there that if you're not cute and friendly, you're a difficult woman and therefore you're unlikable, you know.
Did that reputation that you're talking about, someone who's tough to work with?
I don't have this reputation, but some people before they work with me, they're like, okay, what's going to happen? And then they work with me and they're like, oh, okay.
Right. But didn't that come from a bunch of lies in the 90s where people were making advances that are not?
Yeah, of course. I mean, the minute you say no to a man, it's very complicated after that for you. Like if you say, I actually didn't even say no. I just told someone I knew at the time who was telling me how he was casting his film. And I say, that's kind of gross, right? And he's like, no, that's the way. And, you know, he was like this way of, you know, flirting with people and kind of implying that maybe they're going to get some. Maybe not, but maybe, but you have to, you know. I remember a manager at the time told me something pretty crazy. She says, leave the door open, Julie. I'm not saying to do anything, but leave the door open. Give them a sense that there's a possibility. That was the interesting thing to say.
And that was a woman who said that?
Yeah, manager. You know, it's just very interesting to me that was not acceptable to me. And that was such an accepted thing in a system, right? A system. So, because we're talking about a system, not one or two people. It's a system. Everyone is in on, more or less. So that was tough. And that got me a reputation to not accept that system, right? And this guy told me, I remember very well, he said, yeah, that's how it is and you will never succeed. And da, 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 da. He was very aggressive suddenly. And he got me a reputation. And I was not saying no to him specifically. Actually, he was not offering. But just the fact that I was saying that it's wrong, he was not happy about it.
You left Europe to get away from these kind of older perverse men.
Yeah.
And then you came to America to find
more. To find more. To find more, but more hidden. You know, it wasn't like, ooh, this director's new girlfriend is 14 years old and everyone is embracing it like it was in Europe. It was more like under the radar kind of thing.
And yet you still felt like, I have art that I need to make.
Yeah, that's the weird thing is that I kept on going, but it was a really dark period of my life where I drank a lot.
When was this?
In my late 20s, early 30s, I drank quite a lot. But the good thing is that I got sick right away, almost right away. Like I got pancreatitis, which is inflammation of the pancreas. So I was going to die if I kept on drinking. So it kind of deterred me, you know. I've always had that. Like I do something, I try to do something. I tried to do drug once. I was hospitalized for 2 weeks. You know, I cannot do drugs. I cannot drink. I'm trying to be a bad person. And then I, you know, it's always like that in my life. A little something that helps me out. You know, it's nice. It's actually nice.
We'll be right back after a quick break.
Small business owners, this one's for you. Chase for Business and iHeart bring you a new podcast series called The Unshakeables. this one-of-a-kind series will shine the spotlight on small business owners like you, who faced a do-or-die moment that ultimately made their business what it is today. Join hosts Ben Walter, CEO of Chase for Business, and Tanya Nebo, a lawyer and business consultant, on these storytelling journeys of trials, tribulations, and triumphs that hinged on a single event, a split-second decision, or even a stroke of luck. Whether the story is about a warehouse going up in flames or a former partner stealing a whole roster of clients, each episode will showcase the grit, determination, and resourcefulness a small business owner needed to turn a pivotal situation into a springboard for success. Listen to The Unshakeables now and learn more at chase.com/business/podcast. Chase, make more of what's yours. Chase mobile app is available for select mobile devices. Message and data rates may apply. JPMorgan Chase Bank, NA member, FDIC, copyright 2024. JPMorgan Chase & Co. The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
Smart journalism, fascinating topics, words that describe CNN's podcast, The Assignment with Audie Cornish.
Last year, the Army missed its recruitment goal. It had 65,000 spots to fill and came up 10,000 short of that target. Why is it so hard to recruit? How's the Pentagon responding? And how are the voices of service members on social media shifting the balance?
Listen to The Assignment with Audie Cornish wherever you get your podcasts.
When you look back in those early years, despite all of this kind of nastiness surrounding you and the industry, is there some piece of work that you're proud of?
I have to say Before Sunrise was a film that, you know, yes, we didn't get credited, Ethan and I, and really legally, I can guarantee you, if you look at the original screenplay and what Ethan and I wrote, there is no doubt we would be writers. That was very painful for many, many years, actually, not to be credited, because I wrote very personal thing about love and romance that are iconic, I think, to people that like the series and that are very specifically written by me and Ethan, actually, but really specific things like space between two people or like the fake phone scene, the first film. The other ones we got credited, so it's not a problem.
Are you kidding? I've stole like half of my ideology around romance from your writing in that movie.
Oh, really?
I mean, when I was 20.
When you were 20?
Yeah.
Like when you were flirting? Oh, great.
No,
thank you.
I completely blame you.
Good. No, but thank you.
I grew out of it, of course.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure. Yeah, me too, actually. Yeah, actually, by putting them in the film, it probably, like, it teared it out of my,
right,
me. And I probably lost my romanticism by putting it in that film. No, it's still there. It's still there. I mean, I fell in love not so long ago, 9 years ago. So, you know, it still happened in my 40s to fall in love, really in love again. So that wasn't bad. Yeah, so it was one thing. But doing that film was nice because it, first of all, I was able to write, which was something. And my writing, my specifically the scenes that I had written were pointed out. It really helped me want to keep on going with the writing. I had written before, but not so lucky. I was not able to make my early films, which were also romance. And then I did 2 Days in Paris, which was a romance, but with a more quirky version of a romance. For me, I love doing my own stuff. And sometimes I meet people like Todd Solondz where, you know, I see the writing and I'm like, perfect. I can say those lines. This is real, funny, dark, you know. So some people I want to work with still, so.
It almost seems like you...
I try to avoid the nastiness, you know.
It seems like you wrote your way away from the nastiness.
Yeah, I mean, I write a lot because it helps me also cope with... I just finished my film that I was writing since I'm 30 on Hollywood, which is called 2 Degrees of Fucking Separation. Because if you fuck someone in the business, you have 2 degrees. It's pretty funny. And it's called Or How to Burn All Your Bridges in Hollywood. I don't know if I'll ever find money for this one. It's very, very, very dark. Very nasty, fucked up. And it's very funny, too. And it's crazy. And it's kind of like a horror film. So we'll see if I ever make that one. But it's done, at least.
The process of making those films you're talking about, 2 days in Paris, 2 days in New York. There's a film before that that's completely improvised, but I'm not going to count that one.
Oh, yeah. Looking for Jimmy. Really weird.
The process of making those movies, to bring it full circle, it seems like they've taken a lot out of you.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the problem, you know, because it takes so long to make them. My energy. Also, I'm editing most of the time. I edit. I spend a lot of time in the editing room. And I, as I say again, we're full circle. I want to be less, put less of me in things. So it's not as exhausting. But at the same time, you know, it's a, I think to not be passionate about things can take energy out of you. So I don't know if it kills me or if it keeps me alive.
Every time an article is written about you, they call Ethan Hawke for comment.
He must be sick of it.
And Ethan Hawke, terribly sick of it, gives the same response. It's two words. Do you know what he says?
What?
She's crazy.
He says that?
Yeah. And then you said recently in response, he thinks I'm crazy because I'm a very intense person. When I write or do something, I don't do it halfway. I don't let go easily. I don't give up easily.
But he's funny because he says I'm crazy, but then when we're in private, he says, you're not that crazy. You just seem crazy. We don't know the deeper part of you, because as you're talking to me, you can probably sense that I'm intense. I talk a lot and stuff, but the side of me, I think that's, I'm very settled inside also. I'm not a loose person that doesn't know where she is. You know what I mean? I'm not crazy in that sense. I'm not, you know what I mean, right? Like people that are fragile, that are, you know, that can break, you know, I'm not that. And I think craziness is when people are not attached to the ground. You know, I'm very grounded in so many ways. First of all, I love to eat, which is a sign of being well. You know, I'm not a crazy person in the sense that I'm lost.
I don't think you're crazy at all.
Okay, thank you.
I brought that up because...
He's crazy too, but in other ways. I love him. I love him. I stop cutting you off. I'll never let you talk. It's my podcast.
It's Talk Quickly with you. I brought it up because this line you have, when I write or do something, I don't do it halfway. It means something to me. I don't let go easily. You said that 2 months ago.
Yeah. But that's why I want to try to not get too involved and see how that works for me. It won't be bad. It just won't be me, you know.
Does that mean you're not acting?
I wouldn't be acting, which is great for me. And I can do really good stuff. I mean, I did a film in France called The Skylab where I have a much smaller part. I play a mother and there's many characters. And I have to say, to be directing, first of all, I did a really good job and it didn't feel, I mean, it wasn't a really good job. I did a job that I was happy with.
Why can't you say you did a good job?
Because it sounds pretentious, no? I did a good job that I was happy with. I shouldn't say good job.
Are you kidding? We have... men making movies nonstop talking about how great they are.
Okay. Yeah, but as a woman, you have to be really careful.
Not here.
How you express yourself.
I think you can be proud of the work.
Really? Thank you. Thank you. You're so sweet. I can't believe I'm not expecting so much sweetness. It's making my stomach growl. Maybe I should have had that croissant after all.
What were you expecting?
No, I'm not expecting. But listen, I'm so much in the work that I don't think of anything of myself, what I achieve or not achieve or, yeah, tunnel vision. But that's my only way to move forward, you know.
Do you feel like your best self in the work? Do you feel most alive and maybe happiest when you're in the process of acting or directing or editing or writing rather than everything outside of the frame?
No, because actually I'm very passionate about cooking, about taking care of my kid, about playing, about gardening, all other things. It's music. It's when I draw, when I paint, even though I'm not good at it, I do it in a way that makes me passionate about it, which actually drives people crazy sometimes because, like my husband, for example, he tells me, why don't you chill and just do this to relax? And then I turn it into a passion. It's really like I get passionate about things quickly, you know? The only thing I don't get passionate about is sports. I'm never passionate about sports. No matter what I do, I don't like it. I really hate exercising. Who was it, like smoking a cigar? Churchill? I compare myself to Churchill. That's how big of an ego I have.
Yeah.
I'm about his weight, so yeah. I'm getting there. My goal is to look like Churchill.
You won't call yourself a good filmmaker, but you'll compare yourself to Churchill.
Yeah, that's all. Only visuals. Like, I think I look like him a little bit.
You know, can you stop at that? I feel a certain kinship with throwing yourself into everything you do. And I wondered if that in part comes from your persistent fear of death. Because I find that it's a little bit the reason why I do what I do.
I mean, I think if you don't have a consciousness of your own mortality, you don't really enjoy each second like it's the last. And I do. I do live every moment that way. More and more, actually. That's scary. And you'll see, it gets more. If you have this kind of energy, I think it gets more as you get older. And my dad's like that, too. Every second is like a juicy moment. It's exciting. I mean, I can't say that my life was half lived. It's good, right? Do you enjoy life that way? You couldn't live it any other way, right?
I don't think I have a choice.
Yeah, I don't think we. And it's a curse and a blessing at the same time.
No, I feel it's a curse.
Yeah, but there's that good side to it also.
Now, I have this scene for us to watch that I think speaks to what we're talking about.
Okay.
This is from the film Before Midnight from 2013.
Well, when I think of Elias, what I miss the most about him is the way he used to lie down next to me at night. Sometimes his arm would stretch along my chest and I couldn't move. I even held my breath. But I felt safe, complete. And I miss the way he was whistling, walking down the street. And every time I do something, I think of what he would say. Well, it's cold today, wear a scarf. But lately, I've been forgetting little things. He's sort of fading, and I'm starting to forget him. And it's like losing him again. So sometimes, I make myself remember every detail of his face. The exact color of his eyes, his lips, his teeth, the texture of his skin, his hair. That was all gone by the time he went. And sometimes, not always, but sometimes, I can actually see him. It's as if a cloud moves away and there he is. I could almost touch him. But then the real world rushes in and he vanishes again. For a while I did this every morning when the sun was not too bright outside because the sun somehow makes him vanish. Yes, he appears and he disappears like a sunrise or a sunset or anything so ephemeral. Just like our life. We appear and we disappear. And we are so important to some. But we are just passing through.
This moment was written for, basically I wrote it thinking of my mother. And this idea that people, you know, they also vanish from your memory a little bit, which is the hardest part, I think. And this idea of being here for such a short time. I'm sorry, it's just the only thing that I get emotional about is my mother. It's silly, 12 years ago, but it just doesn't go away.
I presented that scene because that idea of just passing through is kind of what we've been talking about this whole conversation. And I'll say, I watched the film. I was 17. It was right around the time that my grandfather passed away. And I remember watching that, and it was the first time I felt like I could process what exactly had happened.
I don't want people to think that I'm crying because I'm crying to my own writing. I'm not crying to my own writing. I'm crying to basically the idea of processing this, the loss, you know, of people you love. Sorry about your grandfather, by the way. I just lost my mother. I think I wrote this a couple of years after I lost my mother because it was obvious that also the image was fading at times, you know, that it was harder to keep this exact memory of her. And but thank you for noticing it, because in a way, you know, I'm not saying it. I'm not saying those lines, even though I wrote them for her. I thought it was more appropriate for a woman and a man who lost her husband to talk about it. And I thought it was beautiful for an older woman to say it. Yeah, the idea of just passing, and also this this thing I wrote about still there, still there, still there, and then gone, is a reference to that as well, obviously, at another part of the film, looking at the sunset. And it's funny because I found the video that inspired me to write this recently again. And it's the sweetest video of me with my little boy. And I'm looking at the sunset and it's going away. I mean, and the sun is going away, and I say, still there, still there. And then I say to him, gone. And the funniest part is that he panics at the vision of the sun being gone. And it's such a profound image, in a way, of a little child. That's even harder to imagine, because that is not that the idea that this little boy suddenly had this sense of something is going to be gone, you know. And but then I tell him it's coming back tomorrow. But he's still scared of, it's so silly. But it's so profound at the same time. And being scared of death is part of, it's a living hell, really. I'm sorry, I'm just...
You don't have to say sorry.
I'm sorry. Oh, God, I hate crying. I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. I'm so emotional. I don't know. I must be... What day of the month is this? Not supposed to happen anymore. I'm trying to lighten this silly thing, but I don't know. It is a very difficult thing to... Also, when you have a child, it's a great thing, but it's also something heartbreaking, is this concept of he'll be gone too, you know? So it's not an easy, it's a reality. I'm sorry, I made you cry. I'm sorry. You okay? It's just a reality for everyone and for everyone. And we're lucky because we're in an environment that protects us in a way many times, but not always. So
I assure you, people listening are plenty familiar with my crying.
So okay, okay.
It's okay.
Okay, that's good.
That image is haunting. The sun going down and your child there.
It's quite beautiful, actually, because it's very sweet. It's very pure. And I just can't... I have this video and I cherish it because it's so special. And you really see in his eyes this feeling of something ending. For the first time, he understands it, you know. He comprehends it. And it's interesting. I think my son has a deep understanding of life and death and people. And they always tell me how much empathy he has for others, which is a good thing, especially in this world nowadays. But maybe it's going to hurt him eventually. But anyway, that's weird that you picked up that thing, because I somehow had a feeling that people didn't even notice that monologue. And I was almost sad. I was like, oh, I wrote it in this film and now, you know, it's kind of not really noticed, you know. And it was so much about my mother that, you know, I wanted it to stand out. But she says it beautifully, you know. By the way, anyway, is my nose running? No, I'm good. You want to really make me? It's good to cry. It feels good, actually. Actually, my nerve pain is a little better.
The way you're describing your son, someone who's empathetic, who you hope the world doesn't do what it does. It reminds me of how you've described yourself. You said, myself, I'm a good pair, incapable of calculation, so much so that I sometimes have to remind myself not to let myself be stepped on.
Yeah, I have to protect myself, and maybe that's why I'm so hyper and strong and have this persona, you know. Is really to protect myself. My son will be, I think, stronger. I don't know. He's so sensitive to others. It's really shocking to. But since he's little, I've doctor teacher they like. But at the same time, he's strong and he protects himself. So I'm not completely worried for him. You know, one day, I mean, I was bullied a lot as a kid. So, you know, and not that protected at the time. It was another era, but it's a different world. But I'm worried each time that I hear that a kid is telling him something nasty or something because he's so sweet. But I think he has the weapons. He's a little more stable, I think, and he has the weapons to fight back. I think, I hope so.
I think that may come from you.
Yeah, because I, you know, I always take his side. By the way, I had the weapons to fight back too, in a way. And also it's because I love him so much. I think he feels so loved. It gives him the confidence to. And also I tell him, I say, you know, if a kid bugs you, I'm going to go and punch him. Even if he's five-year-old kid. I told him, I remember once we were on a walk and he had told me this kid was bullying him and it was like some nature walk with other kids. And I see the kid telling my son, you ugly, you stupid, like that. And I'm like, I get the kid. He was about 5 years old. I'm like, what did you tell my son? The teachers were like, you can't talk like that to children. He's like, no, he's bullying my kid. Like, I was very straightforward. And actually later the parents apologized because they realized the kid had an issue. He was bullying other kids too, not just my kid. But you know, it's like you gotta, you know, I don't want my kid to be bullied, and I'm gonna be there for him every time. I will protect him until I'm not there.
Walk me through what a day well spent looks like for you.
Oh, you know, the truth is I love creating. But there's nothing I love more than my kid. So spending a day with my kid, doing something creative and fun and playing and having fun and laughing is a day well spent. I mean, ideally is writing before everyone wakes up, doing something I love creatively, preparing breakfast, feeding my family, my husband and my son, and then feeding them more. And feeding them more again at night, you know, and cooking and make them happy with my food and playing and having fun and feeding friends at night on top of it. Family, friends.
A lot of cooking going on.
A lot of cooking. A lot of love given through the food.
For people listening and for you and I here, the goal of the show is to create a time capsule of the moment we're in. And if you and I are to listen back on this in 5 years.
Yeah.
What do you want for yourself?
Well, to be around, for my kid to be well, my family to be well, people I love to be well, and for me to be well, to not be blind, not be with health issues that are too big to manage. The little ones, the pain and the stuff I can manage, but not the big, big ones. And to still be creative. You know, being able to express myself in some ways. And it doesn't need to be films or writing, or it can be anything, music or. But I think if I'm well enough, I would always do that. I don't need to wish that.
I think you're stronger than you give yourself credit for.
I'm not as strong as I look. I'm also fragile. I'm actually half and half of both.
I see someone who's made a lot of films under conditions that were not easy. Someone who's still here. In this moment, trying to say something else, something new. And the film says that we're here passing through. And I just want to say, I am grateful to be passing through with you in this moment.
Thank you.
You okay?
Mm-hmm. I'm good. Thank you. That was a very nice compliment.
You're upset about the compliment?
Very pissed off. I'm angry. No. I'm very happy. Thank you so much. You're very kind.
Julie Dalby.
Thank you.
Stay safe.
Yes, you too.
And that's our show. Special thanks this week to Kendall Heininger and Ruth Bernstein. I'd also like to thank the team at Netflix, and of course, Miss Julie Dalby. Her latest project is called On the Verge, and it's now available to stream on Netflix.
If you enjoyed today's episode, you'd probably enjoy some of my favorites with folks like Poorna Jagannathan, Werner Herzog, Miranda July, Laura Dern, Glenn Turman, and Holland Taylor. You can find all of those and more on Spotify, Apple, Google, and Stitcher. If you listen to our show on Apple, please rate and review. If you don't, share the show with a friend, a family member, anyone that you think may like what we do here. This is an independent program that depends on you to keep going. And keep going, we shall. You can also follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at TalkEasyPod. Our executive producer is Janixa Bravo. Our associate producers are Caitlin Dryden and Nikki Spina. Our lead editor is Andre Lin. Our editor for today's episode is Caitlin Dryden. Our assistant editor is Clarice Guevara. Our illustrations are by Krisha Shenoy. Video and graphics by Ian Chang, Derek Gabrizak, Orion Wong, Ian Jones, Isabel Primavera, and Ethan Seneca. Special thanks to Patrice Lee, Kaylin Ung, and Callie Syringas. And the show is produced by Caroline Reebok. I'm Sam Fragoso. Thank you for listening to Talk Easy. I'll see you back here next week with Nikki Giovanni. Until then, stay safe and so long.
Smart journalism, fascinating topics, words that describe CNN's podcast, The Assignment with Audie Cornish.
Last year, the Army missed its recruitment goal. It had 65,000 spots to fill and came up 10,000 short of that target. Why is it so hard to recruit? How's the Pentagon responding? And how are the voices of service members on social media shifting the balance?
Listen to The Assignment with Audie Cornish wherever you get your podcasts.